Welcome to today's ILTA Radio discussion on the evolution of the legal supplier ecosystem. This will be a podcast where two legal professionals will discuss their experiences, obstacles, and successes. I am Bill Mose, a senior fellow with the Silicon Flatiron Center for Law, Technology, and Entrepreneurship. And I'm joined by Liam Brown, who is the founder and executive chairman of Elevate Services for today's discussion. Liam, can you provide our listeners with a little information about you and your organization?
So as you said, my name is Liam Brown, and I'm the founder and executive chairman of Elevate. Elevate is what we call the business of law provider to law firms and legal departments. We help law firms and legal departments improve quality, efficiency, and outcomes. And we do that by providing a range of services that some people describe as a legal integrator or Accenture for law. And those services include technologies, design consulting services, legal services themselves, and the lawyers, the consulting professionals, or the allied professionals that actually get all this work done.
Great. You know, you and I have had a number of discussions about how the legal ecosystem or the ecosystem of legal providers has been evolving over the past couple decades and where it's headed to. I'm wondering if you could kick us off by just talking a bit about what is a legal ecosystem?
So it's a term that I've heard used a couple of times over the last few years. I remember the first time that I heard it was actually at a CLOC gathering, and CLOC is the group of legal operations professionals that have really developed over the last couple of years at, I suppose, Global 1000 companies. And it refers to the biological concept of ecosystems. And from a biological perspective, you know, an ecosystem is defined by the interactions and the relationships between living things, populations of organisms in any given area, and in this context, in the legal market, with each other, and also with their non-living environment or their ambient environment. So in any ecosystem, each organism or each population, they fill a particular niche and they have their own role to play. So in the legal sense, think of law firms, legal departments, lawyers themselves, this legal operations, emerging legal operations, professionals group, the procurement organization, legal service providers, LPOs, etc., technology providers, and law schools as examples of the organisms that live within an ecosystem. And the non-living environment, the ambient conditions in legal, would include sort of forces or inputs such as globalization, increasing regulation, the influx of capital into legal, the supply, or in some cases at the moment, the oversupply of lawyers, the cost pressure that we hear to do more for less, coming from the CFO, and technology trends such as the emergence of cloud. Now, the interactions which characterize an ecosystem they typically fall into three categories. The first is competition, which is that species compete for limited resources. So think about that as an example of the competition between law firms for lateral partners. The second is predation, where one species kills or eats or preys on another. And an example of that might be how legal departments have the trend for legal departments to bring work in-house, work that has historically gone to law firms. And symbiosis is the third interaction, which is that species live in close proximity to the benefit of both. And examples of that are that the technology providers, the legal service providers, the legal departments, the law firms all have to actually be able to collaborate and all benefit. So it's actually quite, interestingly, it's quite usual when you get to sort of study an ecosystem to see competition, predation, symbiosis all happening at the same time. Now, the important thing to note is that in a balanced ecosystem, over time, these interactions lead to a sort of balanced, self-sustaining community. But, you know, inevitably, along the way, there are winners and there are losers.
It's interesting to hear you describe this in biological terms, because I think you could have the same general description in economic terms and looking at this as a market. Within each market, you have relationships between customers and suppliers, which are highly symbiotic, or partners. You do have competition, which is akin to your predation, and you have co-optition, where members of a market will be both competitors and customers of each other, suppliers of each other. And you know, similar to your point about leading towards balanced, sustained communities, markets tend to move towards equilibrium, although that's an endless journey and all something that is always susceptible to interruption or disruption. And in this case, one of the things I think that you see in markets, which is similar to the biological ecosystem concept, is that disruption in any part of the broader ecosystem, whether it's at the customer level or at the competitor level, is going to lead to disruption across the board. And I think we've seen here over the past number of years, several key elements of disruption that have impacted everybody, starting with the clients and rippling the whole way through. Two things in those areas that have been really key, which are some of the forces that you've mentioned, is the explosion of data and the ability to use technology, and in fact, the necessity of using technology to deliver legal solutions in this environment of much greater data. And I'm curious, Liam, you've been at this for a long time. How have you seen legal ecosystems changing over the past 20 years? And what were some of the drivers of those changes?
So, I mean, I think the first big point is that, to extend the ecosystem thing perhaps one step too much, is I think that legal in some ways as a function, as a corporate function, has been a bit like its own remote Galapagos Islands up until recently. Untouched, so to speak, by outside forces. And I think that in the last few years, and people often refer to sort of 2008 as the tipping point, I'm actually not sure. I feel it's almost really since 2011 on where I really noticed that the legal ecosystem has become much more tightly coupled into the business ecosystem that you in some ways refer to over the last decade. And I think that the drivers for that are, you know, in some ways like the climate change discussion, in that there's little disagreement that climate change exists. There's little disagreement that change in the legal ecosystem exists. But there is lots of debate about the causes and what people should do about it. And I think those environmental changes, such as technology, data, globalization, I think that they are, you know, just a few of the sort of accelerating myriad of drivers. You know, there's this always on service expectation. You know, the legal department has to function, or the delivery of legal services embedded in the business has to function 24/7. Cycle times have gotten faster. People expect immediacy. You touched a little bit about data and the explosion of data is the sort of data, you know, the data everywhere, but also the transparency of that information, the fact that there's this sort of democratization and we all expect information about the status of our orders or the status of a negotiation, and the ability to kind of to connect in on that. You know, we're recording this message just after the Thanksgiving holiday, and that's a perfect example of, you know, I know I was able to actually work on multiple things, you know, at the speed of business, so to speak, because of that automation. The fact is that our European or Australian or Asian operations were, you know, were on while quote unquote, you know, I was on vacation, and the need to be able to operate 24/7 is really the driver of this data. You know, with that comes the opportunity for competitors to build alternative business models and actually come out of nowhere, or feel like they come out of nowhere. And I think that the other thing that's really happening is that the data in the business and seeping into legal has actually caused changes in the way that buyers of legal services behave. They now have much more information than ever before about what legal departments cost, what they spend their time working on, and they're even able to sort of manage and have visibility into the value of those activities and start to assign, you know, where are the best places for that that work to be done. So those are the drivers. You asked, what about the impact of these things? And I think that these are changes in business. And those changes in business have obviously led to the way that the legal department operates. So they've led to changes in leadership, you know, which I would argue has been perhaps the most transformative change. As these new chief legal officers have emerged with this background of used to managing in this change, they've actually changed the structures, they've changed the behaviors and requirements of the behaviors of their legal departments and the tools that the legal departments use. So yeah, that's kind of why I point, Bill, and I'm not sure if you agree with the date of 2011, but that's why I point to that date, because it feels that there was sort of a change of guard, so to speak, in more places. You know, it was almost as if legal departments waited to work with who they had in place 2008, 2009, 2010, and then actually started to make changes, because I see the pace of that change accelerating.
Yeah, I would actually say that I think the change started far earlier, and I would go back to the year 2000, maybe even a little bit before that, because it was the proliferation of the internet and the major advances in technology that I believe have made the globalization possible that is driving a number of these changes. It's also led to the explosion of data. But back in the late 90s and early 2000s, you were clearly looking at the early adopters that were out on the bleeding edge doing this. I think 2008 provided a huge catalyst. Somewhere around the 2011 time that you mentioned, the ABA issued an ethical ruling basically saying that it was okay for lawyers to use offshore resources as long as they took responsibility for the selection, supervision, and quality of those resources and the work that they delivered. So I would agree with you that I think that we're hitting the tipping point, that change is accelerating dramatically, but I think you can trace the root causes of a number of these changes all the way back to the internet boom.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. I think the thing that has really struck me is that in the last 5 years, there's been this rise of legal operations professionals in legal departments and the increasing involvement of procurement or the deployment of procurement practices in sourcing legal services. So, you know, when I look back, at, you know, 10 years ago, I didn't really see people pursuing legal careers in legal operations. But today, I think ACC actually has identified that about a third of general counsel of Fortune 500 companies have added in-house legal operations departments. And if you look at just, you know, let's just take one example, you know, company that we know well, we can see why. If you just look at Cisco, over the past 4 years, Cisco's legal ops head, Steve Harmon, one of the early adopters that you've spoken about it, interestingly. But over the past 4 years, they've saved roughly $30 million through just one initiative, improving their contract management system of working. And that's just one initiative. The whole legal ops program has a battery of such initiatives that have saved Cisco almost $500 million since launching their legal ops program. You know, the other thing that's happened is these legal ops professionals are sharing best practices with each other. They formed this group, CLOCK, and it's become a global organization. They're providing general counsel the ability to operationalize their legal department, to bring work in-house. That's something that's brand new. They're bringing in people, process, technology disciplines to the legal department, similar to what's happened in the accounting organization or the accounting department or the HR department. In 2015, Alton Weil found that 40% of law departments plan to decrease their spending on outside counsel in the next 12 months. And I think that's driven by, you know, it's driven by this legal ops discipline. Now, 76% in that same survey, 76% said that in reducing outside counsel spend, they plan to transfer some of that work to their in-house legal staff. And, you know, I just see that trend only accelerating. The same surveys reported this same behavior every year since 2011. And during that time, law departments have decreased outside counsel spend overall by transitioning more work in-house. I don't think it stops at operations. I think that the procurement organization, while there has been in the past a little bit of a bright line between the legal department and the procurement officer, One thing that I have seen change is that procurement behaviors have really become embedded in the legal department. There's this group that specializes in legal department buying called the Buying Legal Council. And similarly, they've indicated that about two-thirds of Fortune 500 now involve procurement practices in legal services purchasing. And it's reflected in this piece of data. In 2011, only 12% of legal departments were actively using alternative fee arrangements. And today, that's risen to 79%. And I'm talking about things like procurement practices and tools such as matter management systems, billing guidelines, e-billing, outside counsel spend analytics, benchmarking, legal bill review. Those are the kinds of things that are saving these companies millions.
It's interesting to see what's happened over the past few years. I think that the source of this can in many ways go up to the CFO. CFOs during the period of transition that we've been talking about somewhere between 2000 and today have been much more aggressive in requiring chief legal officers to run their departments like a business, to use the same tools and techniques that are being used by the operations groups, the finance groups, the sales groups, et cetera, and take advantage of these tools and technologies. The GCs who have done so aggressively have a very important seat at the C-suite table. Those who haven't, in my experience, are more likely to end up reporting into the CFO than those who have taken these steps. And I really think you do see the influence of the CFOs in the growth of the legal operations groups and the practices that they've gone and spawned.
Mm. I agree with that. I mean, I think if you step back, though, these behaviors aren't only being driven by the leadership of corporations and legal departments or only because there are these other outside impacts as well that I think all factors that are amplifying these behaviors. So, you know, we touched earlier on about the advance of technology, which is a whole discussion, but we've also seen the very successful emergence of substitutes to law firms. You touched a little bit about that with regard to the ABA ruling that basically provided an opportunity for substitutes to provide services that had historically been, you know, the purview of law firms. And they have developed quite successfully over the last, particularly over the last couple of years, and we might even talk about some of those examples. And then the rush of venture capital into the legal sector, which I was skeptical would happen 5 years ago. And I was actually, this was definitely a forecast that whenever I was asked about, I've been proven wrong. Because I think something like roughly $750 million has actually entered the legal sector since 2011. You know, and that's over 1,000 companies that are actually trying to figure out ways to perform legal services, you know, essentially more efficiently or certainly differently, nibbling away at the way that people have worked historically.
So let's talk a little bit about how the different members of the legal ecosystem have reacted to the whole availability of new sets of tools and capabilities that are available to them. And let's start with the law firms. What have you seen the law firms do? How have you seen them respond to the fact that there are now all of these automation tools out there? There are these challenges associated with big volumes of data. There are global supply networks. You have the clients demanding more accountable levels of performance. What sort of changes have you seen happen in that segment of the ecosystem?
So there's been a lot of good noises being made. Certainly the leadership of law firms know that clients are looking for change and in some areas, but it's unevenly distributed. So while there have been pressures that have caused some really difficult economic conditions for some law firms, other law firms have blossomed just by pursuing their growth strategies. You know, in 2011, every law firm managing partner that I spoke to wanted to pursue a strategy of being a global elite kind of top right quadrant provider. But, you know, reality has set in and law firms have started, some law firms have started to think about distinguishing service delivery capability. So there are some great examples. You know, Paul Hastings in the US, Oastlers in Canada, they're examples of some law firms who offer due diligence services from transaction service centers in lower cost locations. So they're bringing efficiency to those clients that care about that. Not all clients care about that all the time, but certainly those clients that care about that can now be served by some firms that are quote unquote delivering differently. Brian Cave have launched an innovation center of excellence. They have been early leaders in investing in innovation and talking about it publicly to clients as a differentiator. They brought together a cross-functional team of attorneys, paralegals, MBAs, software developers, and project managers. They've actually built technology that helps build technology solutions or technology-led legal solutions for clients. And some of them, they and their clients have won awards for that. On the technology front, law firms have become more adept about using technologies and actually using the technologies, not just buying the software and sort of keeping it in one part of the organization, but actually trying to deploy technologies on a broader basis. So, you know, just recently you've seen how Clifford Chance, DLA, Kingwood, Mallesons, Oslers, they've all made announcements about working with the contract analysis machine learning software company, Kira. You know, there are other providers, but, you know, they've done that with the goal of significantly reducing the time that their associates spend on traditional due diligence and obviously reducing the costs that their clients incur. You know, my company's worked with Gowling WLG to implement a project management software or approach that is just enough. And, you know, this legal project management approach is something that they've taken to market as under the brand Practical LPM as a way to differentiate and ensure that they deliver client deliverables transparently and make sure they stay on budget. That's been helpful for them in building their business. Ashurst is an example of a firm that has partnered with one of these legal service substitutes that we might talk about. So they've recently partnered with Axiom in a JV to help banks work on some new derivatives regulations. You know, Axiom does a bunch of the work on pulling out key data from existing documents and creating new documents. And Ashurst provides the advisory services to clients on how to write new rules on the approach to signing these new agreements. So, you know, those are four or five different examples, but there are probably, I mean, there was 100 great examples. Remaking Law Firms was a book that was released earlier this year by Dr. George Beaton, and it has some great examples of global law firms actually adapting to the kinds of changes that we've been talking about.
I would add one additional trend to the points that you've observed, and that is it seems that the number of boutiques have expanded as well, and that you see law firms today, a certain segment of them, becoming much more focused on what is the specific market niche that they are focused on. There's always going to be, at least in my opinion, a need for high-level advice and legal guidance. And you see a number of law firms that have moved into becoming real specialists in those areas, trying less to be all things to all people. The litigation boutiques are probably the most pronounced example of that, but you see it in venture capital law, technology law, that sort of thing as well. What about the non-law firm providers? How have you seen them evolve?
So I've spent, you know, in disclosure, I've spent a lot of time actually in this space. Before starting Elevate as one of these legal service providers, I started a company called Integrion, which was one of the first, you know, LPO providers. So I've been observing these businesses or participating in these businesses for some time. But look, I think there are a couple of stories around these substitutes. The BTI's study in 2016 showed that about 60% of clients that they interviewed would not refer their law firm to a peer, which is obviously, you know, not good news for law firms. But at the same time as that study was released, Deloitte released a study that showed that just over 50% of clients are considering buying legal services from law firm substitutes. So there are, I mean, I think there are two themes. The first theme is the new providers that have emerged, the LSOs, the LPOs, the tools vendors. So an example of that, our, you know, Elevate's primary competitor, an alternative legal service provider that many people know, Axiom, it's raised over $65 million of capital. Last year, it was publicized that it had crossed the $200 million per annum sales mark. It, you know, they describe themselves as a leader in the business of law, providing technology-enabled legal contracts and compliance solutions to large enterprises. So they're very focused. They combine legal experience, technology, and data analytics to deliver work in a way that dramatically reduces risk, cost, and cycle time. And they've got about 1,500 lawyers, process engineers, and technologists that serve over half of the Fortune 100. So, you know, they're a substantial company as an example of the success of new providers. And, you know, they've got real case studies. They have one case study on their website that refers to the work that they did for a public consumer goods company on a demerger. And they had a team of their project managers, lawyers, and paralegals work over 60,000 hours over about a year and save the client about $5 million compared to what they would have spent with a traditional law firm. So that's work that would have gone to a traditional law firm. And their CEO claims that they'll become the largest and most innovative provider of legal services, and that they're onto a way of working with clients that could fundamentally change the entire business of law. Now, I picked them. There are many other providers. 10, 15 years ago, they didn't exist. And now they have become a substantial size firm. But I think the even more interesting story is the adjacent providers. The adjacent to law firm providers have expanded. You know, the big four have enthusiastically entered this space and have started to take share, provide legal service to many of their clients as part of their end-to-end, broader, multidisciplinary engagement. So often, this is work that law firms don't even see. They've got deep relationships with the C-suite well beyond just the general counsel, and they've already grown very quickly. Last year, Deloitte reported 17% growth, or just under 17% growth, which was their sixth year of double-digit growth. And I think they have around 1,700 lawyers in that group. PwC has over 2,500 lawyers globally. And in some markets, Germany, as an example, I think The Economist reported that in Germany, as much as 20% of the legal market is in the hands of the big four. So, you know, I think that substitutes are becoming an important player, an important member of the ecosystem.
There's an added factor to that as well, which is as the substitutes become broader and they become more specialized in areas, and as you said, you listed several examples, but there are literally hundreds of tool vendors that are out there, other alternative legal service providers, adjacent providers, and such. The kind of the third area that I've seen grown tremendously is the one that you mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, which is the in-house departments. Mm-hmm. The in-house departments have taken more and more things in-house internally. And in my experience, they've done so for two reasons. The first is basic economics. If you just take what a typical law firm lawyer charges per hour, and you go and multiply that times, let's say 1,500 hours per year, that's a pretty good budget that you can usually drive a savings from if you have that much work for an in-house lawyer to do. Second piece, which is where I think things will grow, is the integration piece. With all of these different types of providers out there, it takes a real skill set to be able to understand how you take a legal problem, which is really a business problem, you know, a piece of litigation, a big merger transaction, or something like that, and how you break that down into its constituent components, identify who the optimal provider is, and go and source that out appropriately, make sure that all of these different providers are communicating with each other, and assemble the results back into a work product that's both very high quality and economically desirable. So I would add the in-house department as a third group that has grown tremendously. And my sense is it will continue to, because it needs to provide that sort of integration role with the business that they're uniquely positioned to do.
Yeah, I agree with that too. That legal integrator capability is something that is emerging as an increasingly sophisticated requirement, and the market isn't populated with lots of people with that experience. I mean, I just think about some of the graduates from law schools that we hire, and I mean, you know this because I think about some of the graduates from a law school for the program that you managed in Colorado, and it's only now that we're finding that we can recruit lawyers with what, you know, we describe as these T-shaped lawyers that have capabilities beyond simply legal training, people who actually have familiarity with data, people who understand, who have project management skills, people who actually have business skills or empathy with the ability to put themselves in the shoes of clients. There's a whole range of things that are required. And I agree with you that the legal integrator, you know, I think I introduced that company in that way. I think there's an increasing demand for people who can actually tie this together. And so I think that's increasingly important for in-house legal departments. I do think that the participants will have to actually play nice with each other. Again, going back to the ecosystem piece of this, you know, I've seen law firms in the past sort of pay some lip service to client requirements to work differently and have been dismissive about some of the early stage legal service providers, what I think I call LPO 1.0. But if you really look at the successful companies and law firm relationships that have worked with the Big Four and the more sophisticated legal service providers, I think what you're starting to see is people are starting to work together. All of the members of the ecosystem are learning to interact more seamlessly with each other. But there's a long way to go, and there are challenges with that.
I think you hit the nail on the head as to what the single biggest challenge is going forward to the further evolution of the ecosystem, and that's getting people to collaborate more closely. If you look at some of Richard Susskind's writings, you know, he's talked about a number of different trends, automation, process evolution, and such. One of the ones he talks about is collaboration, which is, I think, the one that is still open for the greatest possibility of further development. And I think that's going to come from several different places. The first is, and probably the most challenging, is just a change in attitude and approach. And just as you've seen businesses go and decentralize the way they do things, they've decentralized their supply chains across the board in order to be able to be very flexible, very nimble, have just-in-time suppliers, and have learned to integrate those partners into the broader ecosystem of the company. I think you're going to see the same thing, or at least tremendous pressure for the same thing to happen within the company's legal ecosystems. So the first is people have to get comfortable with that, and that's going to take a bit. There are security implications associated with that. There's a great fear of releasing competitive information and such, although I would note that businesses have gotten over that by using things like Salesforce.com and other cloud solutions for hypersensitive information like your sales pipeline. And the second piece is the technical one. I think knowledge management systems, which is really what we're talking about, how do you make sure that the work done by one provider is accessible to another provider in the ecosystem without them having to reinvent the wheel, and that everybody contributes to it? I think that's going to be the platform. And you know, we've seen a lot of aspects of those systems develop, but I don't know that you're going to see a single monolithic system. I think it's going to be lots of components that get integrated together. And in order for them to work well, they're going to have to connect three different groups of people. They'll have to connect the members of the ecosystem themselves. And by connect, I mean have people both contribute to the pool of knowledge and use it. They'll have to connect with the business itself, the broader aspects of the client community. And they will have to connect with the external market generally, because a large part of that information will be very valuable to driving your solution quickly. If you want to know whether you should settle a case or not, you probably want to know what happened before that judge in similar cases, even though they didn't involve your company. So you need that broader set of connection across all of these different layers. So I don't think you're going to end up with a one-size-fits-all system, but I do think you will start to see more common components and more standardization across the way that key data gets collected and stored so that it can be used in a meaningful fashion across the board.
Yeah, I think that's also, I think that's absolutely spot on. The behavior of this clock group that I've come to know is that they really are focused on, where possible, standardizing and reusing knowledge, which sounds, you know, so what? Well, what's interesting about that is a lot of the work that I've seen them start off with in the beginning was all sort of around process standardization. So, for example, outside counsel guidelines, big, thick documents, very complicated. Law firms have tried to respond to that by throwing all sorts of resources at billing departments, et cetera, to kind of, you know, improve e-billing unsuccessfully. The legal departments have, you know, implemented automated legal bill review technology. So that kind of made the problem even more pressing for the law firms, who now had, not only did they have these 150-page outside counsel billing guidelines that they had to satisfy, they were actually being policed by the robot, so to speak. So, you know, this all put, this put even more pressure on them. So, but it was easy to kind of retreat behind these sort of lawyer-to-lawyer discussions around, oh, it's just too complicated. We have 20 customers with these massive guidelines, and, you know, and so we can't comply. It was just too difficult. So sort of throw the whole chessboard up in the air. What's happened is these legal operations people, these legal procurement teams have actually said, well, let's simplify the guidelines. Let's work together to develop just a sort of 12-page set of guidelines and make sure that 80-20, the tools that we use are only actually focused on 80% of the things that we need to keep an eye on. And what's starting to happen is the standardization that started off as process or in documents is starting to find its way into code. And I use the outside counsel guidelines one because it kind of reflects both law firms, the work between law firms and legal departments, the OCG and e-billing capabilities. But it's happening everywhere. It's happening in contract management, etc. And I think you're right that there is going to be a lot of focus in the next 5 years on systematizing, using tools to actually tie together the way that we all work together. I look at my own company, and certainly that's a big part of what we've been building, is modules for a way a legal department operates or a law firm operates that are, you know, in the background, we actually tie together. You know, it's early stages, but I do see that more and more and more we are going to have a common platform for legal work emerging between all of the players, the legal department, the law firm, and the legal service providers.
So let's get to the fun part, sum up and get some thoughts as to what you think this means for the various participants in the legal ecosystem over, say, the next 5 years. What do you think this means for the law departments, for example?
So I think that you might disagree with me on some of these things, but we do have some agreement. So I think you touched upon it. They are increasingly likely to serve as legal integrators. Law departments will have lawyers. I'm not sure they'll have more lawyers. They'll continue to have lawyers doing more of the legal work, but there will be more people inside legal departments who have the expertise in assembling and managing the delivery of legal services. And they'll be more expert at sourcing the legal work from their internal lawyers, from outside counsel or legal service providers, and being able to respond sort of fluidity in their business. They, instead of kind of the monolithic legal department that has always, that just looks the way it has always looked, they'll be able to respond to the evolving demands and capabilities requirements that, say, the accounting department or the HR department or the sales department has to respond to in a company life cycle.
I would agree with you there. To add a little bit to what you've said, they will be the ones who generate the business requirements for the solutions that the legal services are providing. In other words, if you analogize to an IT product, they're going to define what the problem is, what success looks like, and then go and help assemble the network necessary to go and deliver that solution. I agree with you. I think that they will continue to grow, but that the lawyers in the group will become a smaller percentage, and they'll probably be more senior roles as on average than they are today. What about law firms?
I'm quite an optimist about law firms. While I do think there will be winners and losers, I think that law firms will continue to do what they do best in the sort of in their advisory role, in that they perform bespoke advisory services. And I think that that'll continue to be their core business. I think that they'll move away from, in general, there'll be a couple of vertically integrated law firms, but in general, they'll move away from trying to sort of be all things to all clients, i.e. trying to actually have an efficiency operation as well as an advisory operation. I think there will also be, there'll be businesses and companies like firms like Allen Overy have actually demonstrated that they'll be able to sort of follow perhaps the McKinsey model of actually develop a very profitable content business. And you touched on it earlier on. I think there will be some firms who just do a really good job of laser focusing in on an area of specialization where they actually have the expertise, the methodology, and the tools to be a dominant player in a specialization area.
I would agree with what you've said there. The one thing that I would add is that I think that the days of law firms being able to market themselves by saying, we have the smartest people in the room, come look at our resumes and leave it at that, are coming to an end. I think increasingly the law firms are going to need to be able to show, we are the best provider of this particular type of service in a specialized area. So I think over time, you're going to see them get much crisper in terms of what they specialize in. You know, you have a number of firms that are moving towards organizing around industry verticals. You have the boutiques that we mentioned. I think you're increasingly going to see that, and that the value proposition will become much crisper than it is. And I'm also bullish, like you are. I think there's, while you're seeing a lot of consolidation in the law firms right now, I think there's tremendous opportunity out there for those who really do analyze what part of the market they want to be the very best at and go out and execute on that. How do you see them playing in this whole
thing? So look, I think the big four are going to be very successful. I think they are going to make the most promising play, or most likely be successful play, to be the one-stop global provider. They've got all sorts of advantages, particularly around their adjacent capabilities and competencies, tax, accounting, systems expertise. I'm working with a law firm right now, a legal department and a law firm right now that has actually really shifted work that historically had been this one law firm's kind of integrate post-M&A integration work. This legal department has actually shifted it from this law firm to a big four. And I just see that trend increasingly likely. And I think there are some firms that can challenge them, but there are going to be very few. I mean, firms like Dentons or Allen Overy, who have global footprint or global scale, and who have, you know, their own version of sort of global set of practice capabilities. I mean, I think that there are some possibilities of a couple of firms challenging them, but my view is that the big four are going to, if we have this conversation again in 5 years, I think the real success story is going to be the big four.
I think it's hard to argue with that. At the same time, I look at the panoply of areas that the legal services market covers, and I think there's an awful lot of them that the big four are not well suited to go and occupy in a meaningful fashion. Where you're talking complete global coverage or something that requires large amounts of scale, I agree that they are likely to be highly competitive, but there are a number of bespoke areas, and that's where I think the firms will continue to have an advantage. Mm. What about legal service providers?
I think it'll be harder for, you know, I'll call it my community to have the same scale success. So I think they'll be very successful in certain niches. So I think that the historic kind of LPO, kind of pure efficiency piece, I think they'll be successful there. I think there will be other niches around things like designing solutions. I think integration, I know certainly Elevate's really focused on that. Particular areas of expertise, like, for example, you've seen how successful they were in litigation document review, bringing the people process technologies together for that. I think they'll do the same thing in contracts. I focused, one of Elevate's practice areas has been legal ops. So I think that legal ops will be another area that will be an area of success for legal service providers. So I think that market has grown quickly and continues to grow very quickly. But I think that we're going to see the early investors actually exit those investments. I think there will be a lot of experimenting that will have mixed results. And I think you'll see kind of shift of strategy. And I think you'll also see some market consolidation as some of the legal service providers acquire, you know, each other or gobble each other up. But I don't see a massive influx of new providers, I think what you'll see is a kind of a measured growth of those current providers. But I don't believe, I mean, I read somewhere that Axiom would become the largest law firm in the world. And I know it was a bit of a breathless industry commentator blog, but I just think that the normal kind of business challenges of running a company at scale and having multiple competitors, et cetera, I think they all start to come into play. So success, but nothing like the success of the Big Four.
So what about legal tech vendors? My sense is that that's not quite as mature a market or sub-market as the legal service providers, and that you will continue to see a fair bit of growth and change. I know at least today I'm seeing very rapid evolution in a number of areas, particularly involving machine learning. As I mentioned earlier, I think that there's a tremendous need and opportunity there for technology that furthers the collaboration between members of the ecosystem, including things like data repositories, analytics, knowledge management systems, et cetera. Is that consistent with your views?
Yeah, look, I think there's going to be an explosion. I mean, it's a sort of, in many ways, it's the pre-Cambrian explosion of legal technology vendors right now. So this reminds me, my very first business was a virtual data room company that I built back in the internet days of the late 90s. And this feels to me, legal technology now feels like the explosion of internet technologies back in the late 90s. And lots of these companies are not going to be successful. That doesn't matter, because the problems that they're looking to solve are they sort of all stand on the shoulders of the companies that were just ahead of them. So there's no doubt in my mind that machine learning is going to be a really important part of legal service delivery or legal analytics in the future. There's no doubt in my mind that the ability to understand data and have the data actually inform legal decisions is going to be an important competitive, well, it'll be a differentiator for a couple of years, but it'll become something that, you know, every player is going to need to be able to, you know, have as a capability. So I think tech will drive a lot of the change. I think there'll be lots and lots of companies that are in this space. The real challenge is making sure that you don't get tied into a technology that isn't going to exist in a couple of years. But there'll be a lot more technology in legal than ever before.
Well, going back to something you mentioned earlier, I think all of these changes have profound implications for law schools. And as you said, the value of being a T-shaped lawyer, I think, is only increasing, especially if you're looking to pursue a career in one of the more non-traditional employment sectors of an in-house department or a non-traditional legal service provider. I do think that traditional doctrinal law courses will remain very important. You know, you have to understand the content of the service that is being provided, but I think that there's also a risk of having both too much or not enough for certain roles. 3-year program has been under assault for quite a while, and you're actually starting to see a large number of 1- and 2-year programs, Master of Law programs, coming up. I believe a year ago, there were close to 70 accredited law schools that were offering those. You're seeing a rise in joint degrees to go and build the T-shaped skills. A number of law schools are letting people take classes in their business schools. I think you'll see a blur between the offerings of law schools and business schools. And just speaking from my personal experience of running the Tech Lawyer Accelerator program at Colorado and teaching in Bill Henderson's program at the University of Indiana, the students that are getting these skills and are coming out T-shaped are doing pretty well employment-wise.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think about kind of the number of lawyers that we've hired just in this last year. The vast majority of new lawyers that we've hired have come from the kinds of programs that you've spoken about.
So final closing question for you. Should lawyers feel threatened or excited about the evolution of the ecosystem?
I notice you asked the question, should lawyers rather than law firms feel threatened or excited? So, because I do think that's a difference between the answers. So I'll answer the question you asked. So look, I think that the evolution of the legal ecosystem is just like the evolution of any ecosystem. And we talked about how it balances over time. So I think for lawyers who are themselves adaptable or who work for organizations, firms, legal service providers or legal departments who work for organizations that are adaptable, this is a great time. This is a fabulous time, fabulous opportunity. I think those lawyers who see all of this change as nothing to concern themselves about, or they don't have curiosity about it, or they aren't willing or able to adapt, or work at organizations that suffer from the same limited perspective, I think that they will feel pressure, and in an ecosystem sense, they will decline or they'll simply die out. And I realize that sounds dire. And as I said at the beginning, but while I'm an optimist for law firms in general, I have observed over the last couple of years, there are winners and losers. And I think that for the lawyers inside firms, more than ever, there are winners and losers. And I would strongly encourage any individual lawyer to, as I say, to be curious and think about their practice and their clients and really listen to their clients about what are they looking for from them in the future.
Well, thank you, Liam. We appreciate your time today and your joining us. I would encourage you to continue the conversation on ILTA's Connected Communities. Have a good day.